Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. This morning, I am going to read an updated version of a soliloquy I wrote a few years back for the defunct North Coast Times-Eagle, which was rewritten from an earlier screed. I am not reading it to suggest that certain repulsive aspects of human behavior seldom change, but that they are predicators of ever more grotesque future depredations this current era is fomenting. Today's choice of materials is inspired by a Belgian priest of the late 19th century, Father Adolf Daines, who was also a member of Belgium's parliament during that period that King Leopold was personally enslaving Africa's Congo as his own fief and murdering the populace as though it was his personal holocaust. Father Daines fought for the rights of the poor and was a vigorous advocate of labor rights. He also opposed the king's rape and murder of the Congo. Thus, he was kicked out of parliament and defrocked as a priest. These were words he spoke to a crowd in response. Remember that you have only one enemy, those who exploit you. And remember, you have only one ally, those who suffer beside you and with you. So now, children of darkness, which is my opinion, and perhaps only my opinion in all the dark cosmos. The myth is that the Liberty Bell cracked on its first ring. Many omens, portents, and certainly myths have been drawn from that first of many cracks to the bell. Often is not dark and gloomy for the Yankee Doodle democracy, some, with emphasis on that census, some, had been constitutionalizing and also baptizing with 10 secular commandments that everything else more or less flows from and rests upon simultaneously. There would be no liberty so long as black families were enslaved by the very men who proclaimed freedom and equality for themselves, but not for women of any color. No liberty so long as Indians were being exterminated. No liberty so long as economically deprived whites were forced and deceived into enslaving their own minds and bodies to substitute one form of aristocracy based on blood for another on property and capital. The divine rights of freedom and pursuit of happiness 2.5 centuries ago were only for the privileged, the Washingtons, Jeffersons, Hamiltons, Cabots, and Lowells, the landed aristocracy, slave owners, and wealthy merchants. Put to its first internal test of principle, an important and enlightening implication of its external purpose and method, the United States of America failed its citizens from the start. Soon would begin the elaborate deception through propaganda and eulogy, justifying the considerable inequities within the burgeoning society. Too maladroit to deal with the descent of free citizens' guaranteed constitutional rights and obligations for peaceful protest against government, governmental agencies, local, state, and federal, generally threaten obvious and overwhelming violence against dissent, spreading fear through other troubled citizens to justify force arrayed against dissent, insinuating vast conspiracies where there are none. The structure itself a faltering sham of democracy and victim of its own intrinsic delusion. The success of revolutions, violent or bloodless, quite often depends upon the proper moment and inspiration. Perpetuation of the institution of violence, generally considered the prerogative of the state, is quite unpopular as a method of challenging the state and brutally repressed. Our ancestors had about a third of the population behind them when they started their revolution, about the same quota that is relentlessly huckstered by Donald Trump, although the ideological political split in the country today is virtually down the middle between blue and red. However adamant forces for overt revolution from the left or right-wing coup d'etat are considerably fewer and certainly much less popular. It must also be understood that the violence the state is capable of cannot be matched by any assemblage of revolutionary-minded heretics. From a political angle, revolt is not an option. Urban guerrillas make good horror stories for newspapers, TV, and the internet, but the great majority of Americans will regard any such actions as terrorism, despite their varying degrees of disagreement with the governing party. However, the majority in this country does not consent to terrorism in regards to other countries. They justify extermination of other peoples if perceived as a threat. Told they must be afraid, they accept carnage if patriotically portrayed. They allow abominable acts committed in their names under a mistaken assumption, planted with fearful demagogic agitprop, that they are protecting the American way of life, which is always in danger, of course. Americans have always been a contradictory people, advancing liberty and civil rights while simultaneously eroding them when denying them to others, foreign and domestic, who are considered unworthy to share the American dream. Politics are a tone and expression of a culture reflecting all of its manifestations, its arts, its music, its sciences, its philosophical and spiritual approaches to life, its basic functioning as a social organism within its environment, essentially for the purpose of amicable cooperation between its members and appendages. Throughout history, politics have been perverted and manipulated into becoming self-serving entities, counterfeit and repressive, separate from their mother cultures, not only contrary to them, but preying upon them also. Governments formed to handle changing stresses, needs, and desires become instead inflexible and self-preserving, repressing progressive change. Institutions we have created, whether political or religious, become corrupt and unresponsive to our needs. Institutions are essentially maintained by subjugation and fear. The rule of law is a substitutive modification of overt violence, a gloved fist bared against its malefactors, often responsible through repression and deprivation for the desperate crimes against its authority. Such institutions have perpetuated themselves by forcing their detractors to adopt similar methods of rebellion. The faces may change every so often, the priorities and spoils realigned, disguised even, but the very utilization of actual and conceptual violence against such a system only sustains the institution's violent legacy. The American Revolution serves as an example. There was no other way to create change than through war. Liberals who had only modified the colonial institution were compelled into becoming radicals determined to violently overthrow that institution because Imperial Britain would have it no other way, incapable as it was of satisfying liberal demands, thus radicalizing them through frustration and repression, capable only of oppressing an issue to an exploding point, then meeting it with its armies and Hessian mercenaries. After its stubborn vitality kicked out the archaic and weary British with a little help from the French, the newly created revolutionary institution, for the most part aping traditional standards in its laws and concepts, such as retaining slavery, became an oppressor, putting down the so-called Whiskey Rebellion or Shays Rebellion after the revolutionary soldier who led it, a few years later with an overwhelming use of force designed to serve as a warning to future rebels. Created through rebellion, the institution would not tolerate it further, turning the violence of its inception against its own people, preserving itself at all costs, congenitally as incapable as Britain of fundamental change despite the radical exception of the Bill of Rights. The Whiskey Rebellion had not even been a conceptual or philosophical challenge. It was simply economic and political. America's presumed manifest destiny has been a problem long before now. It was the rallying cry that nearly exterminated native inhabitants, decapitated the head of Mexico, threatened Canada, and seized an island empire from moribund Spain. And that was just the beginning. The usual response to critical questions is not rooting out fundamental flaws to correct them. Instead, elaborate contrivances and deceptions are superimposed to so conceal and disguise these defects that even the swindlers themselves are duped by their own prevarications and illusions. It is apparent such flawed institutions are able to survive their baffled and superannuated exploiters or their ilk. No matter how artificial or intricate a fabrication, these conglomerate predators yet remain resilient enough to endure varying amounts of strain up to the point of blowout, which, of course, is an intrinsic guarantee of predatorial continuance. Of all the enemies of any institution, secular or theological, the most dangerous are their founders, however sincere or humane their goodwill and purpose. In general, the founders were against, or claimed they were against, institutions to begin with, understanding their depersonalized, almost inhuman nature, and the last thing they seemed to want was still another one created with their name on it. Not all, of course, but such prophets as Jesus, Gautama, Sam Adams, Karl Marx were anti-institutional, spending their lives defying them. But after they were safely dead and buried, they were warped into institutions themselves, airless and forbidding when not tyrannical or warmongering. Once given shape, an institution develops a sovereignty of its own independent of its creators, which can range from a few men or women held together by hardening concepts, an embittered gorilla cell, perhaps, to a sprawling octopus of immense proportions, such as the Roman Catholic Church or the economic, military, political mafia of the United States. To survive as an entity, it is necessary for an institution to eulogize and institutionalize its creators at the same time effectively destroying their very rationale for establishing it. These human-made structures become cannibalistic if they would continue to exist, if their managers and eunuchs would profit from their eminent status, if their laborers maintaining functional operations enslave themselves for the false security and prominence they believe worth sacrifice of their minds, bodies, and perhaps moral and personal values, and certainly years of their lives. Institutions must obliterate human taint and become gods and fathers, certainly not mothers, to the men and women spending their productive lives within them. Instead of serving humanity, they reduce humans to impotent peonage, demanding servitude and absolute loyalty from the depraved vassals. Robotics are the next wave of institutionalization. Paradoxically, there are no such entities as institutions, only humans indoctrinated from birth to venerate and perpetuate institutionalism. American society operates essentially on the basis of capital accumulated and exchanged. Its caveat emptor morality, justifying any means toward monetary profit, its very nature based on competition and self-repression, threading malignancy through class, racial, and gender segregation and repression to genuine isolation of each person from another. The economy itself is expansionist, otherwise it would collapse upon itself, as it is presently doing anyway. We are all born into this artificial climate, regardless of race, gender, or economic class. American society has itself lost whatever intrinsic mobility it might have had, if it ever did have much. The class lines are perpetually rigid. Race more than ever determines class position and privilege. In the past, American society proved too heterogeneous to form any solidarity among Blacks, Hispanics, Asian Americans, Native Americans, women, workers, farmers, and everybody else. American capitalism and its concomitant imperialism has been too strong to break, resilient enough to come through the worst economic crises. Perhaps even more inclusive, American political rebels have generally failed to see future social developments within contemporary society, unable to keep pace with its tremendous changes, able sometimes to respond and patch an impairment or another, but never ready to build a lasting entity that would successfully defy the expanding misanthropy. Restricted by its mainly middle-class base, the white reformist movement in the USA, which has been, however unintentionally, a perpetuation of white preeminence, perhaps more humane, but white supremacy nonetheless, eschewed methods it could have adopted that were germane to primarily white-oriented groups, and instead impotently caricatured styles and goals of the Black movement. not a bad thing in itself, giving whites an enlightened empathy they might otherwise have ignored. The danger lies in the inability of white progressives to approach groups as labor on their own grounds and deal with their individual problems, bringing them in successive stages into at least an understanding and sympathy with third world peoples and aspirations. The Black Liberation Movement itself grew to the most powerful, most original, creative, and dynamic political crusades in this country's history. For three centuries, New World whites butchered and manacled blacks who, in spite of horrific oppression, yet managed to develop the richest culture in the Americas outside the native Indian. Up against the wall for insidious crimes, whites angrily argue the black must not seek revenge, but instead accept the re-enfranchised neo-Jim Crowism being layered all over the United States. Whites fail to understand why American blacks disassociate from them. Black culture is far more vibrant and real, while white American culture is more or less sterile, impersonal, and bleak in style and philosophy, retaining most of its racial savagery. The true American God is money and profit. There is hardly a comparison. What good whites might have offered, blacks accepted while whites were losing it. White American culture has transposed material abundance for liberty and equality. Aldous Huxley suggested the Industrial Revolution was the downfall of humanity. Means became ends, and the human spirit suffered for it. Perhaps a deep sense of Black American culture that was called soul eludes compassionate whites, an Achilles heel clinging to a primarily middle-class base, a germ that became the diseased yuppieism that consumed former hippie radicals. A distinct Puritan streak was likewise the downfall of the old new left of the 1960s, a mistaken impression that white radicals were the only true missionaries of liberty and justice for all, a maverick contradiction, if not actually their undoing as a positive political force. It certainly was a perpetuation of arrogance and elitism that proved decidedly counterproductive and unable to resist the future lure of yuppiedom. The 1960s anti-white war movement was a direct outgrowth of radical tradition in the USA, dating far back beyond the first European settlers escaping old world repression, before Spartacus even, or Moses, a great radical who managed to set his people free from slavery, prior to their crucifixion of another popular radical who offered them no material advantages for throwing off their Roman conquerors a few centuries later. However obscured both biblical liberators have become through religious myth and invention. Despite the abundance of American white radicalism in the past, it yet found itself justifying too often the annihilation of the Indian, the enslavement of blacks who constantly rebelled against white feudal domination, the bigotry towards newer groups of immigrants clambering off ships at Ellis Island, the Irish, the Italians, the Slavs, and other Eastern European peoples, Jewish of any ethnic nationality in particular, and especially Chinese and Japanese, who, as indentured workers on the West Coast and Hawaiian Islands, promptly became virtual slaves and victims of white nativist oppression. Although there had been a strong tradition of white radicalism, the combined legacy of their works and aspirations, perceptions, and truths are nearly buried in obscurity. The young white radicals of the 1960s were in the main rather historical, if not anti-intellectual, in the tradition of radical politics, and they committed the same mistakes as their historical predecessors, such as the secular utopians of the 1830s and 1840s, who did not, in their equally ahistorical consciousness, concede the false yet enticing seduction of industrialization. The abolitionists, who failed to see the social transformation, the implications of emancipation provided for a socio-economic base for blacks and whites to live and work together. The late 19th century agrarian radicals who strove too late to save the vanishing aesthetics and verities of a rural life already gobbled up by the ever-expanding urban-based industrial economic system. the old socialists of the World War I era, who concentrated on building a strong force of organized skilled laborers and ignored the latest batch of immigrants who were hungry and eager enough to force basic labor changes through the newly organized Congress of Industrial Labor, the CIO. The homegrown American communists of the 1930s, who paradoxically discarded cultural reality and creativity to meet changing local problems for Russian methods and phraseology, constructing a popular front in the USA whose very existence depended, again paradoxically, upon the continuance of Roosevelt's New Deal during the Depression 1930s. The German radicals fleeing the Nazis in the early and middle 1930s, who infused the decaying movement with a new and real vitality to counter the pro-Nazi German Bund in the USA, but whose effect culminated in the hopeless crusade and draining off of the best and brightest of their generation to the civil war in Spain on the Republican side against Nazi-backed fascism. The American government repressed the survivors by considering them as communists and so-called premature anti-fascists. The short-lived, drug-inspired counterculture of the Beats, also known as beatniks, that arose in the 1950s as a direct result and antagonist of the McCarthy purges, more disposed toward Eastern philosophies and unorthodox styles of life and art than towards overt political involvement. The civil rights activists of the early 1950s and 1960s, both black and white, who stood up or sat down against Jim Crow in the South, integrating schools and registering blacks to vote. And the offspring of the Beats and civil rights activists, the Vietnam anti-war movement, the primarily white resistors of those idealistic years who were allied with Vietnam veterans who opposed the war, formed the first wholly radical organization in decades. By then, even the old hardline American Communist Party, created by Oregon's own John Reed, was as worn out and conservative as the established power structure itself. Yet for all of its reasoning as an antagonist to established law and order, its opulent idiosyncrasies, internal splits and factions, the white American radical movement of the Vietnam War years did not last long afterward. It faltered by essentially institutionalizing itself. The older groups, such as Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, became increasingly narrow in scope. Its breakaway weather faction demanded the privilege of using the state's violence against itself, holding it accountable for the desperation leading to those acts. But it went no farther, calling for revolution, parroting third world styles not particularly applicable to this multiple jointed heterogeneous society as a whole. Some of the old self-styled leaders buried themselves in quick and easy solutions, washing their hands of winning over the labor movement, considering it hopelessly privileged compared to third world peoples, or dismissing it with traditional Stalinist demonology, ignoring the obvious historical and contemporary fact that the mass of American labor holds the ultimate key to which way the revolution goes. Others of the old radical fringe swallowed centrist theory or mad elitism, more or less becoming that strange twin to the white anti-war radical movement, the well-dined and connected yuppie. Still others gathered such a following and prestige with their radicalism, they evolved or devolved into establishment liberals and campaigned for political office. Perhaps the greatest weakness of the resurrected, struggling democratic socialist movement from its inception has not been so much its racial exclusiveness as its middle-class base and organizing around college campuses, insulating itself from the average American working person who has been generally unable to identify with leftist progressive goals. As a result of not gearing its purpose toward the great mass of alienated and insecure American labor, and ignoring labor's goals that promote grassroots collaboration rather than corporate schemes based on war and imperialism, the white radical socialist movement gave piously fraudulent politicians an edge toward manipulating the working class into a tool of its own oppression. Old traditions, ideas, and institutions die hard, stingy, and prolonged deaths. Those counterculture children of half a century ago who failed to change cutthroat rivalry into cooperative magnanimity were yet a spark of change, flowering seeds of the first multiracial transgender culture this ruptured society has ever forged. Often isolating themselves and repressing one another, they sometimes lost sight of their overall objectives, which were, as simply put, a world of women and men of all creeds and races equal in a social, cultural, and economic value sense, working for and not against each other, appreciating and encouraging diversity, whether cultural, racial, or individual, with a common understanding humanity is a single species that can survive only through harmony, depending upon and thus cooperating with one another. One of the primary enduring myths is that civilizations and nations collapse when they have become permissive, immoral, and lacking the will to fight any perceived enemy. That is patently untrue. Nations and states fail when they have lost faith and trust with their peoples, when they no longer even pretend to meet or respect the most basic material and philosophical needs of their citizenry, when they have lied to them and exploited them cruelly, when they have become repressive and overextend their oppression to satisfy the empirical ambitions of an insatiably privileged minority. So it is happening within the United States. It has stretched itself too thin, has ruled high-handed over too many people for too long. It has substituted artifice for substance, defrauding its citizenry with bright baubles of mediocrity, claiming material prosperity while millions lose their jobs and homes. Repression escalates against the desperate and hungry. Internal imperialism intensifies its dominance politically and economically to protect the wealthy from domestic collapse from their own avarice. Yet the country resists progressive change. Change creates chaos. History, while refusing to honestly chronicle the lives of the great mass of ordinary citizens, perpetuating elitist perspectives instead, does at least present a few examples of response toward chaos. Faced with social chaos and the breakdown of order, ordinary people grasp desperately at oppression simply because it purports to be a base of stability and order. But the history we think we know betrays us. The chaos during times of change is not from new and rising ideas and forms, but comes directly from the decaying institutions committing suicide to stay alive through absolute repression. Yet when so many demand change, there is obviously a desperate need for it, which too, contrarily, often ushers in despots and inquisitions. The world's wealthy elite seem to have already mapped out their strategy for self-preservation from immense human tragedy, whether wars and famines or political upheavals from especially the non-rich majority of peoples on the planet. Empower Hitlers as heads of government, although that did not work out well for German elites, and Donald Trump is no Hitler, despite his twittering fantasies. The angry, leaning pressure of increasing humanity might yet have the last word as it seeks to rectify the monstrous inequities between the world's haves and have-nots simply to survive, perhaps necessarily overthrowing despotic governments and privileged institutions if their fundamental needs are not met. On such a low intellectual level will quite likely come the dynamics of world revolution. This is Michael McCusker. I close today's program with a poem by Cher Zanera, who wrote it when she was 15. We are all in waiting to see if something will take us and melt the past, which is only a reminder to a place where we listened and decided our futures.